Hello, I'm Linor Mudu. Welcome to Health Chat. The 16 days of activism against gender-based violence kicked off on November 25th, a global campaign to call for the prevention and elimination of violence against women and girls. UN data show that over the course of their lives, one in three women will face some form of gender-based violence. The UN marks the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women with a new report on the issue. A study by the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime indicates that more than five women or girls are killed every hour by intimate partners or someone in their own family. The report is a reminder that violence against women and girls is one of the most pervasive human rights violations around the world. James Shimanyula has more from Nairobi.
Speaking from United Nations headquarters in New York, United States Sarah Hendricks, Director for Program, Policy and Intergovernmental Division, called UN Women, shed light on intentional killing of women or girls because of their gender.
Femicide rates remain at alarming levels, with more than five women or girls killed every hour by someone in their own family. And we know, of course, that behind every data point, behind every statistical point, is actually a lived life. It's actually a real woman or girl whose life has been very brutally and often very abruptly ended just because she is a woman.
Hendricks disclosed the details of the problem with the terse comments on the tough conditions under which women's rights organizations are operating.
Today's women's rights organizations are operating in an increasingly complex environment where they're facing threats to their very survival, where they're facing a significant shrinking space for civil society, and where there's a growing backlash against civil society and against women's rights in particular.
The UN report says of the 81,000 killed last year, nearly 60% were murdered by intimate partners or other family members. Asia recorded the largest number of gender-related killings overall compared to women and girls in Africa who are more at risk of being killed by domestic violence. In Africa, 2.5 females per 100,000 were killed compared to 1.4% in the Americas and below 1% in Asia and Europe. South Sudan, Africa's newest nation, takes the lead in high cases of violence against women and girls over the past 6 years, as Betty Murungi, prominent Kenyan lawyer and human rights defender, tells us.
Rape and crimes of sexual violence have been perpetrated on a staggering scale.
Murungi then turned to the Horn of Africa, where a peaceful atmosphere is now prevailing after more than 2 years of fighting between Ethiopia's federal forces and rebels belonging to Tigray People's Liberation Front.
Since the conflict began, the Ethiopian and Eritrean forces and regional militia targeting Tigrayan women and girls with violence and brutality. At times, the attackers used dehumanizing language that suggested an intent to destroy Tigrayan ethnicity.
The UN is calling for greater support and protection for survivors, including by police and judiciary, and an end to harmful masculine behavior and social norms. Its report cites Kenya as an example of progress where the government is collecting data on the violence and has established a toll-free line to assist with emergencies. 54 private shelters and rescue centers now operate in 18 of the country's 47 counties. For VOA Africa News, I'm James Shimanyula in Nairobi, Kenya.
In the Democratic Republic of Congo, women represent about 51% of the population, according to UNFPA, and gender inequalities are particularly observed in economic, political, social, and cultural settings with a direct impact on gender-based violence. For more insight, I spoke with Dr. Eugene Konwe, UNFPA representative in the DRC.
Gender-based violence is cuts across both the rural area and the urban area. It cut across also levels of education, although it is more common in women who are less educated. But it cuts across because it is grounded on the tradition, on non-social norms that tend to affect everyone.
In an analysis, UNFPA found that, among other things, traditional and religious practices have some negative impact on gender equality in the DRC. How so?
Tradition is good. There are forms of tradition that actually protect people, especially vulnerable women and girls. But there are other forms of tradition that also exposes and increases the risk of gender-based violence. We are working with religious and traditional leaders to see how we can put an end to them.
And speaking of that, you have initiated the Lubumbashi Forum on Tradition and Religion to put an end to gender-based violence in the DRC. Talk to us about this initiative. What does it entail?
The objective of the forum was to bring together traditional and religious leaders to reflect, to brainstorm on the strategies that they can put in place in order to address gender-based violence. Because it is grounded in tradition, we look at gender-based violence in the development setting, not just humanitarian circle. The second thing is that it was the first time that we brought together both religious and traditional leaders to sit together on one table from all corners of the country and try to find out what they can put in place in order to address gender-based violence. And the third thing that makes it particularly important is that we know that religious and traditional leaders do not work alone. They work in an ecosystem. So we also brought the other players to sit with them on the table, such as civil society, women association, the young people, the government, the donors, the UN agencies, to sit together and listen to them and support them.
When we think about tradition and culture, it's so entrenched into people's habit. How do you convince them, and how much of an impact are they willing or able to make when it comes to changing traditions?
One thing that actually also surprised us is that most of them, if not all of them, are actually very progressive. They want to preserve the good tradition, but they're open to actually put an end to the harmful practices. So they were quite excited to come and see how they can work together. So much so that after the conference, they decided to sit together and actually start brainstorming, that for the first time, they're able to sit and discuss some of the common issues that face them.
So what transpired from the forum, and what are the next steps?
The religious and traditional leaders drafted the Lubumbashi Declaration to end gender-based violence, and all of them, they signed the declaration. The second thing that happened is that they developed their action plan, concrete actions that they're going to take in order to ensure that their declaration is implemented.
Rape as a weapon of war. What is your take, and what is UNFPA doing on that front?
Gender-based violence as a weapon of war still happens, and it happens in the context of humanitarian crisis in the context of armed conflict. And actually, I'm happy to say that the government is aware of this. And last year, the president of the Democratic Republic of Congo created a national fund for the reparation of conflict-related gender-based violence, and also created a national commission for transitional justice to bring justice to the victims of conflict-related gender-based violence.
We've also seen that during COVID-19, gender-based violence has increased in some parts of the world, including in some parts of Africa. What can you tell us in terms of the experience in DRC?
The impact, given the fact that the lockdown was not that much serious in DRC as in some other countries, the impact wasn't that much, but it affected and had an impact in the terms of the number of cases that we are seeing. There's a database, but the database just show the tip of the iceberg, because there are many cases of gender-based violence that do not actually come forward, because women, they face stigma, they fear retaliation. So many of the cases, we cannot actually get them.
What do women do to protect themselves?
First of all, to talk about women protecting themselves, men need to also protect the women. They have a strong role to play, because that is why UNFPA engage boys and men in the process, because they are the cause and the solution of gender-based violence. We have been working with women, but working with women without getting men involved won't provide a solution that is comprehensive, that we can finally say we have put an end to gender-based violence.
Now to South Sudan, as the country joins the rest of the world in marking 16 days of activism against gender-based violence, activists are calling on the government to address sexual violence across the country. South Sudan's Minister for Gender, Child and Social Welfare, Aya Benjamin Wariel, says gender-based violence has infringed South Sudanese cultures, and her ministry has received an alert from a whistleblower about a serial rapist in South Sudan capital Juba. The 16th day of activism against gender-based violence are being marked under the theme Take Responsibility, Protect Women and Girls from Gender-Based Violence.
Daniel Mature is a whistleblower who have been reporting cases of sexual exploitation and abuse. He recently alerted the ministry about a suspect who allegedly has sexually abused patients at Juba Teaching Hospital since 2015.
And he committed these acts way back in 2015, according to the videos that we have, when he has been bringing in women and young girls to his office that was then located within Juba Teaching Hospital in Juba, South Sudan, sleeping with them. Video evidence show rape with the young girls and the women, some of them giving cash. And on top of this, he seems to be taking the videos of the act himself. And the evidence we have shows about 9 victims sexually abused and harassed and raped.
The 16 days of activism against gender-based violence kicked off last week with activists calling the government to address sexual harassment in the country. South Sudan Minister for Gender, Child and Social Welfare, Aya Benjamin Warile, says it is sad that people in South Sudan have been protecting an alleged serial rapist.
It is very unfortunate that we also got a report of a serious case of sexual abuse from a prominent member of the society. We condemn this as a ministry. It happened long time ago, and we are happy that it's already in the hands of the law enforcers. So we encourage people to report cases. We know this thing happened long time ago, but it's never too late.
Warila asked stakeholders in the 16-day campaign against gender-based violence to take up their responsibilities and report all abuses to her office. The suspected serial rapist has been arrested and investigations are ongoing before he is charged in court. In May, an Awil court sentenced a man to death after he was found guilty of raping and killing a 12-year-old girl in northern Bahr al-Ghazal state. For VOA News, I am Juliana Shapai in Juba.
Still in Sudan, officials say cases of the gender-based violence have increased significantly over the past 1 year in various locations, including the in-conflict affected areas of Blue Nile, Kordofan, and Darfur. Suleyma Al Khalifa, who heads the Combating Violence Against Women at Sudan's Ministry of Social Development, says lack of accountability and the rule of law has affected proper documentation of the atrocities committed against women. Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
As part of the 16 days of activism against gender-based violence, a Sudanese government official says her office has informally documented dozens of incidents of violence against women and children over the past year. Speaking to South Sudan in Focus in Khartoum, Suleyma Al Khalifa says most of the cases were reported by community leaders and some women's groups during the recent conflicts in Blue Nile, Kordofan, and Darfur. She says the lack of proper government structure since last year's coup has hurt efforts to properly document incidents. Khalifa says she could not give an exact figure, but says cases have increased significantly.
Well, we know there's cases, and we know it's true. They don't need verification, but actually we cannot say that now. Because, you see, when things are not documented and things are not well, they were not well informed and communicated, we cannot say numbers, but we are aware there's cases, different cases of this.
Speaking during his visit to Sudan earlier this month, the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, said his office has verified 19 incidents of sexual and gender-based violence. He said most attackers were police officers as they cracked down on protesters. There may be more, he said, but victims often do not come forward due to deep social stigma, lack of faith in the justice system, and fear of reprisals. Al Khalifa says when people lose confidence in the justice system in the country, they often turn away and prefer not to report.
There's no accountability for the whole state, and cannot report this to somebody and try to get some kind of action done. And we are working in this very much difficult situation.
Hala Al-Karib heads Sudan's Office for Strategic Initiative for Women in the Horn of Africa, or SIHA. She expressed deep concern over what she termed as growing crisis against women in Sudan. Speaking to this program in Khartoum, Al-Karib says her office has documented over 20 cases of rape and other sexual violence against women in both Blue Nile and Lagawa area of West Kordofan state in recent months. She says thousands of the displaced women live in camps where they are exposed to gender-based violence.
The level of tension is very, very high, you know, and the situation when it comes to sexual violence, the attacks against women farmers and women who are trying, you know, to harvest and so on. It's extremely, extremely difficult at this point. So it's a growing crisis, you know, if you add to that the situation in Darfur and what's happening there.
Al-Karib attributed the increase in gender-based violence to lack of rule of law and growing communal conflicts in the country. She called on the authorities and the international community to join to protect Sudanese women.
This is not a security process alone. This is an extremely comprehensive process that incorporates a lot of issues, including issues of access to justice, including issues of governance and control of civilians, of their own governments at the local level.
Intercommunal conflicts have been rampant in Blue Nile, Kordofan, Darfur, and Eastern Sudan since the Sudanese military leader Abdel Fattah al-Burhan staged a coup in October last year. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
A Zambian gender activist says the worrying trend in Zambia about gender-based violence is that usually a woman is killed. Beauty Katebe, who is also former chair of the Zambia National Women's Lobby, says Zambian women need protection. This after Zambian police Thursday say they recorded 8,790 cases of gender-based violence countrywide during the third quarter of 2022. The figure was 4,042 in 2021. Katebe tells VOA's James Batty, married couples and children in Zambia need protection.
I think the reaction is always the same, because anything that is negative, the expectation of a normal citizen is to see a reduction in the numbers as you go by. And what is very worrying for us in Zambia is that the gender-based violence that we experience today is very different from the gender-based violence that we experienced yesterday, because the one we are experiencing today is characterized by killings. Either a woman will kill a man or a man will kill a woman, of course, with a bias towards the women being the most victim in the cases. What I would want to say is that maybe even as I speak to you, I would still urge the families to strengthen efforts in the protection of married couples, children, and of course the women in these cases. It's quite alarming that it becomes very difficult for me even as an activist to comment on them, because the worrisome situation, as it were.
Tell me which one you think is correct, Beauty. Some people are blaming this on frustration by men because of what they call the poor economy in Zambia, while others are saying that this is just due to power play where men try to exercise their superiority over women. Which one is accurate?
It's actually both, because, as I mentioned earlier, a good number of women are dependent on men. And those men, if they don't find anything meaningful that they should do to bring food on the table of course, there is that frustration, there is that hunger, there is that anger, and it brings a lot of confusion in the home. There are certain households that are living below $1 per day. Those are houses where you find that people fight even over food, over a very small amount of money that was supposed to be spent on this, and the wife has spent it on a different thing, and there will be a big fight.
Thank you so much again, Beauty. It's very nice to talk with you.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to talk to you too.
That was my colleague VOA's James Butty speaking with Zambian gender activist Beauty Katebe. All eyes are on Qatar as countries compete to bring the FIFA Football World Cup home. The World Cup kicked off in Qatar and one major African soccer player, Sadio Mane, is not participating due to an injury. A sports injury involves damage to part of the body due to sports, exercise, or athletic activities. Research published in the Journal of Orthopedic, Journal of Sports Medicine says soccer is associated with high injury rates. Experts say a good preparation is key to lowering the incidence of sports injuries. They say taking care of mental wellness is equally important during preparation, and addressing athletes' mental health is essential to their overall well-being.
High-level sportsmen will face each other during the World Cup in Qatar. Each team presents itself with its own weapons and strengths. Physical problems have been numerous, causing the withdrawal of many stars. In addition to the physical aspect, another aspect is very important for those high-level athletes when they start the competition, the psychological preparation.
The big difference between athletes and footballers is the psychological side, which we call anxiety, the mental side. Today, all the studies have shown that the mental side represents nearly 10% of the sports performance. That is to say that if he's prepared at the same level, the one who is stronger mentally wins in 70% of the cases. And this is a very important element that is demonstrated today in all sports and especially in all team sports. There is also the spirit of winning, which everyone must be animated to be able to effectively surpass themselves. So the psychological side today is very important. 70% of the performance today is due to the psychological and the mental side.
The preparation, the surpassing of oneself to be at more than 100% and to take each match as the last one with a final victory in mind. All this will be determined during this competition.
This period of the competition, a high-level competition, it's necessary that the players are fit physically first, then mentally, psychologically, and at the same time disciplined, and have confidence in themselves and manage the games one by one. It's a high-level competition, and today almost all these players are tired because they have too many competitions in their legs. So it takes a lot of discipline. It requires a lot of confidence, and it requires a lot of self-sacrifice.
Amadou Traoré, who was himself a footballer in the 70s, believes that in order for youths to reach their full potential, it is necessary to work on cleaning up the environment to ensure that the daily life outside of sports is not a hindrance to the achievement of the objectives of the group.
When a player has problems, especially family problems, it's really difficult mentally for the player to spend time, especially if a father or mother is sick or a family member has had a problem, accident or death. So the player has this stuck in his head. It can reduce him mentally by 50%. He will play, but he will not have the full time of his form.
Which nation can win this World Cup? Dr. Sangeri has his own idea.
The team that will win will be the team that will not only have cleaned up around, but will also have put in place a recovery system at the top level, and will have the possibility of calling on several players.
Another way to say that, even though teams like Senegal and France have lost their leader of the attack, they can still have good results thanks to their mental strength.
Dr. Paul Onyedo is director of the Sports Medicine Department with Nigeria's Ministry of Youth and Sports Development. He discusses some ways to lower the incidence of injuries when practicing sports.
Okay, if you talk about injuries in sports and football in particular, the better classification is to use the regions, you know, region of the body. The knee is the most common region you expect an injury, and then the ankle. Possibly these are the first two to think about, and then the groin. Injuries are classified. You have mild, moderate, severe. You know, when you talk about the muscle, for example, you can have a strain or you can have a tear. If you just have a mild strain, it depends on how many strings are involved, how many fibers are involved. So you can have 2-3 days, the person is back. But if you have a tear, you can talk of months. So the duration is a function of the severity and the nature of the injury. When an injury happens in sports, it's already a disaster. Options. Usually, we are very conscious of time in sports, and then you are conscious of functionality. So the best approach is the cold approach. If injury happens immediately, the common practice is what we call RICE. Rest, ice, compression, elevation. The first 72 hours is cold. You don't bring heat. If you bring heat in the first 72 hours, you worsen the situation because tissues react to injury by inflammation. These are some of the difficult things in the job. You know, sometimes when you practice sports medicine, you are like, who brought me here? Because there are situations that arise, you are expected to play God, and it's difficult to play God. Once an injury happens, and then you don't allow the injury to heal properly and properly rehabilitated to what we call return to play, there are criteria for return to play. If you don't follow that, which is sometimes what happens, especially when you have a very important superstar, a very important player, you know, if you don't follow that, the tendency is re-injury. Or you get, and when that starts happening, it gets worse. And when it gets worse, even when you rehabilitate that person, that place may not be as strong, because the principle is to rehabilitate to as near normal function as possible. I can tell you that once you have a major injury, to get that body part to that normal, the way it is originally, it's always difficult. There's always a deficit, even though it may be small. One of the most difficult jobs in sports medicine is when an athlete is injured, because it's a disaster. The athlete is not happy, he's very angry, because it's like tearing somebody's degree certificate. Okay? You know what sports is. When you are injured, you have issues. Maybe you are competing with someone, you sit on the bench, the person comes in, he plays well, you remain on the bench. You are worried, are you going to recover? Are you going to recover well? An injured athlete faces a lot of challenge, and most of the challenge is psychological. It's medicine, it's psychology. You have to understand it, because you have to get the athlete buy-in. If the athlete does not buy in into your program and do the rehab properly, there's a problem. Prevention is extremely important in sports. Then the player themselves should make sure they have their protective equipment. They have to make sure that they wear the proper things. I've seen a goalkeeper, a female goalkeeper, with a wedding band. Just to stop a shot, the wedding band formed a fulcrum, and it had traumatic dislocation. Wear your shin protector. Wear the correct shoe. The field is wet, it's slippery. Then you are wearing soft boot. You can slide, and that is it. And one more properly, it happens so many times. Even big players, they're excited, they'll come into the field and start shooting immediately. They don't warm up properly, they don't stretch, and then... So the players must know it, that even if you're a very, very big player, injury does not spare anybody.
That's all for this edition of Health Chat. For more health news and medical breakthroughs, visit voaafrica.com. Thank you all for joining us, and special thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Linor Mudu in Washington, with producer Mukbil Yabaro. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and strive to make every day a healthy day.